Parshas Korach is about the eponymous Korach and his rebellion against Moshe. Didn't succeed, of course. There are a lot of different dimensions to what Korach did. There's the theological aspect, the heresy. He denied the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu. He claimed Moshe was simply a man acting on his own for his own desires. There was the Korach's ego, Korach's sense of injustice and of being mistreated. There was the democratic or leveling impulse. Korach says, "Kichol ha'eda kulam kedoshim." It was a kind of anti-elitist point Korach was making. Everyone is worthy. Everyone, all Jewish people, are worthy of honor and power and authority. And why you? Famous Midrash elaborates on this. It talks about how Korach asked Moshe for talis, that is, all tchelis needs tzitzis. Jews are all holy. Why do they need special holy men to be at their, to lead them? And a house full of svarim doesn't need a mezuzah. Why should it? The Jews are like a house full of svarim. All kinds of different dimensions to Korach's sin. At heart, of course, Korach is just a rebellion. Korach is rejecting the authority of Moshe. He claims that Moshe has unjustly usurped power. He claims that he, representing his people, he has Ohn ben Peles and Dasan and Aviram and 250 men and important men. He claims he leads a considerable faction who do not wish to accept the authority of Moshe Rabbeinu, who want to throw off the authority of Moshe Rabbeinu. They are wrong, of course. Moshe Rabbeinu is acting as Hashem's prophet. What Korach has done is a terrible sin, and Hashem punishes him and his followers accordingly. So I want to speak about the general question of the right to revolution in Judaism in general. A lot of what we covered tonight we'll have touched on, we'll have discussed in the past, but introduce some new stuff and cover it from a different angle maybe. I want to discuss the question of the right to revolution in general, the right of a people to throw off the authority of their sovereign, to depose a monarch, to secede, so to speak, to reject their government. And from there, maybe go on to some questions of some of the Jewish rules for governance in general. So there is perhaps a surprising paucity of literature in our tradition on the question of rebellion, the question of the right to revolution. So here, in the 20th century, we live in a country founded on the right to revolution. We have the Declaration of Independence, in which Jefferson makes this point very, very acutely about how it's the right of a people when the tyrant is usurping their rights and taking advantage and behaving unfairly, with a due respect for the opinion of mankind, which is why they're going to list all the whereas, all the things King George did. They have to explain what he's done, that because you do have to have a explain why. You can't just do it for no reason, but Jefferson makes the point that the people who are being abused by a despot have the right to depose him, to secede, to rebel. Jefferson is echoing John Locke, who also talks about government, talks about how the ultimate sovereignty is in the people. Power flows from the people. The right of the monarch is a delegation from the people, and the people have the right to withdraw the sovereignty from him. This is the theory of the social contract, the idea that the legitimacy of a sovereign derives from the consent of the governed. That's what I remember vaguely from elementary school and high school civics, history, and so on. And so the question is, what does Judaism say about this? What does Judaism say about these notions? What is rooted the right of the monarch, both Jewish monarchs and monarchs in general? And is there a right to revolution?
The assumption, I guess, is that Korach never heard, or for that matter, when God speaks and basically reorganizes the relationship of God and Moshe in front of Aharon and in front of Miriam. Klal Yisrael did not hear that.
Right. So
had they heard that,
they wouldn't have challenged Moshe in that way. Right, and the truth is, when we read about Matan Torah, Hashem makes the point that Matan Torah was a special case in which the Jews would hear God speaking with Moses, and the reason is, Gam b'chayaminu la'olam, that they were supposed to extrapolate, generalize from that we see Hashem speaks to Moshe, so in general, we're not going to be around for those conversations, we should trust that it's Hashem speaking to Moshe, but right, I think everyone pretty much assumes they weren't privy to every single conversation Hashem had with Moshe, and therefore they could say that he spoke to him once, he spoke to us once, but who knows what he told him since then. Moshe's gotten overweening in his desire for power, I guess, right. So, the single most interesting discussion of the right to revolution, one of the very few discussions that there is at all, is a passage in the Abarbanel. A remarkable passage. Now, Barbanel is writing again about the turn of the 16th century. He says that he debated the matter with his Christian colleagues, the other courtiers in the king's court. He debated this question. He says, the question is, if the melech is ra ublial. In the past, we've discussed Abarbanel's positions on political thought in general, his attitudes toward democracy, and so on. But here, discussing the monarchy, he says, if the melech is a tyrant, he calls him a ra ublial, evil and a scoundrel. Tzorach lachka, we have to ask the question, he says, if it is appropriate for the nation to rebel, as the people did, people in the time of Rechavam did. They had a disagreement about tax policy, and Rechavam had different advisors pushing for a harsher tax regime, a more lenient tax regime. Rechavam chose the stricter, harsher one. The people rebelled, and ten tribes went with Yeravam. So he says that the Chachmei Ha'umos, the Gentile scholars, by which he presumably means the Christians, they considered this question, and they were men ahead of their time. They were basically nascent Enlightenment thinkers. They said it is appropriate to rebel. It is appropriate for the people to throw off the yoke of the tyrant. He says that's what they felt. I was the reactionary. I took the traditional view. I spoke about this, lefnei malachim im chachamim, in the presence of kings and their sages. One imagines he may not have had much choice in what he could say in public. I don't know how his Christians got away with it. Jews probably have an additional handicap in what they could say. But be that as it may, Abarbanel seems pretty proud of what he said. He doesn't, if with just apologetics, what he's about to record, I don't know if he would have needed to proudly record it for posterity. See, this he seems to have actually believed, sincerely held what he's about to say. He says, I argued the case, the reactionary case, in the presence of kings and their scholars. I demonstrated it is not appropriate for a nation to rebel, no matter what degree of tyranny and despotism is exhibited by the monarch. Afshir Shial Koldvar Pesha, no matter what he does, it's not appropriate. And I made three arguments for this position. And we'll discuss his three arguments. In advance, I will note that I don't really understand the arguments that well, and none of them seem entirely persuasive. I suspect many of you will not find them entirely persuasive, certainly from our modern perspective. But we'll discuss Abarbanel's points, and then we'll discuss some of the counter-arguments one could make to them.
Do we know if he wrote this before the expulsion or after?
It's a good question. I don't know. I don't know if it's knowable in the sense if we have a good timeline. He discusses some of his commentaries when he wrote them. This particular comment, this is in his commentary to Shoftim, the end of his commentary to the Torah. I don't remember if he wrote this. Certainly a valid question. Would his opinions have been changed by the... In theory, they shouldn't, because he's conceding for the sake of argument that the king is a tyrant. He's saying the melech was marshi al koldvar pesha, and still he argues, still the fact is, going through it personally sometimes changes your mind. So, yeah, definitely a valid question. I do not know the answer.
There's corrupt and then there's evil. Is he only talking about non-Jewish?
He's going to discuss both. We'll discuss. He makes three arguments. Two of them apply to any government, including non-Jews, and the third is specific to Jews. First argument he makes is he concedes the modern theory of government, that the right of the government derives from popular consent, from the consent of the governed. However, he says, that consent, once given, cannot be retracted, cannot be abrogated. He says, the contract is absolute. You know, ordinary contracts contain clauses for default, for breach of contract. This contract, he says, contains no such clause, no such outlet. No matter what the king does, the contract remains binding, he says. Inena b'tnai, it is not conditional, it is an absolute grant of authority, and can never be revoked, can never be retracted. Now, the problem with this argument simply is that he asserts it, but he doesn't really prove it. Intuitively, you know, logically, it would seem reasonable that a grant of sovereignty would be conditional. Again, if we had an actual text where we granted, in a constitution, we granted him sovereignty, we could analyze the text and see what it said. In the absence of a formal grant of authority to the monarch, we have to just make assumptions about what is the how their arrangement should be reasonably understood. Certainly, we post-Enlightenment people would say it goes without saying that it's contingent on good behavior, that we grant him sovereignty insofar as and as long as he keeps up his part of the bargain. He rules wisely and well and for the good of the public. I certainly could have heard that the contract is conditional. Abarbanel says no. He understands that the general contract by which a sovereign is awarded power is unconditional, is absolute. This is his position. So again, we can guess or no. He assumes that the grant of power is absolute. One could have argued the other side, presumably his Christian colleagues who disagreed, may have felt that the like the later thinkers did, later Enlightenment thinkers did, that the grant of sovereignty is conditional, implicitly conditional, and can be revoked. Second argument that Abravanel makes is that the king, he's not quite going to a divine right of kings argument yet. He's conceding that, when it comes to non-Jewish kings, he's conceding that the authority of the sovereign also really derives from the consent of the governed. It does not derive from any kind of divine right. Nevertheless, he understands that the king is in some sense analogous to God. The king is sort of a diminutive version of God and should be treated with the same level of respect and deference that we treat God. That's why he has absolute power, just like God has absolute power, he says, and that's why he says, you know, he's an individual. Again, this applies more to single autocrats rather than democracies. Abravanel himself, as we noted previously, as Benjamin pointed out, that Abravanel speaks quite highly of the republics, the Italian city-states and their republics. He is quite admiring of non-autocratic rule. But here he says the classic autocrat, the king, the dictator, is in some sense analogous to God. That's why we make the bracha when we see a non-Jewish king. We say, shechalak mikvodo, that he has given part of his kavod, he has kind of delegated part of his honor to a mortal, because again, the king's honor is in a very real sense analogous to God's honor, and so on. Chalak liyareyev, for a Jewish king, he says that, and they should be treated like God, and therefore it is inappropriate, he says, for the people, for the public, to lay a hand, to raise a hand against their king, to depose him, because that would be almost like raising a hand against God. An unthinkable thing, he says. That's what David HaMelech said when he was in his conflict with Shaul, and he once had the upper hand on Shaul, and he could have killed him, and he said, I couldn't do that, he says. He says, how can I raise a hand against the anointed one of the Lord, he says, because again, he's a king, no matter what he's done, no matter what he's done to me, no matter what my grievances are against him, I can't lay a hand onto the anointed one of the Lord. Now again, one problem here, certainly something which we are very familiar with today, is the question, in general, we can consider the question of whether a king is really above the law in general or not. Halacha does not generally recognize that a king is above the law. This is obviously a very contemporary question today, but the halacha most certainly does not recognize that a king is above the law. The halacha is melech Yehuda don v'danino, so he can be judged for crimes. Melech Yisrael, in principle he can, but there was a rule that ain't done in because it led to certain political instability. It led to certain problems if they tried to subject him to the ordinary, tried to indict a sitting monarch, so to speak. What is the recourse then if the king is abusive? Not entirely clear. But the point is, halacha definitely has no general rule that because the king is somehow godly and analogous to God, halacha certainly has no rule that the king is exempt from any kind of check and balance on his power. Certainly, halacha does recognize that melech dananoso, that Abravanel's assertion that the king is a kind of godlike figure and is not subject to the judgment and any kind of review or check by his subjects, is not something that has any clear source in Judaism. It is true that there is a crime of marid b'malchus, there is a crime of rebellion lack of deference to a king. That's a king who is behaving properly, a king who's wise and honest and righteous. If you disrespect him, yes, the king has the power, the king has the authority to kill him because it's necessary to preserve the authority and the respect of the state. But the idea that the king should not be subject to any check against abuse of his power, that the people should be completely disempowered from any kind of check against him, is not something with any clear basis in Judaism. Again, the Abravanel asserts it, but it is far from clear that this has a solid source in the Jewish tradition. Just going back for a moment again, returning to his first point is that the contract is absolute and therefore we can't abrogate it. He also adds another point within that first argument. I'm not sure if he means this as a sub-argument or just a rephrasing of his first argument. He says, "Ki ein ha'am imashi yavchin tzedkaso rishaso." The people, again, are not the ones empowered to make judgments about his righteousness or his lack thereof. Again, the question is, why not? If not the people, and who is? If there's no other body appointed to sit in judgment of the king, why is it obvious to him that the people are not empowered to make this judgment? As we said, the melech is done v'danino, so it's not clear why he takes for granted that nobody can judge the king, nobody can review him and assess his performance and his integrity. So these are the Abravanel's first two arguments, regardless of the counter-arguments, but these are his first two arguments, and these are not specific to Jews. A, that the social contract is unconditional, binding, absolute, and the people have no review power to assess any kind of compliance or living up to his side of the contract, and B, that the king is supposed to be viewed as a godlike figure, kaviyachal, in this world, and that people have no right to behave to him as they would to their fellow Jews, subject to critique and review and so on. His third argument, he says, is specific to Jews. He says, among Jews, sovereignty is not simply a social contract. It's not simply consent to the governed. He says, Jews do not appoint their melech, and therefore it follows logically that they're not the ones who are empowered to depose him. Who does appoint a Jewish king? He says, Bechiras HaMelech is not a question of popular sovereignty. It is not Biyad Ha'am. It is not by popular election. Kiyim Biyad Hashem Yisbarach. Appointing a king is God's choice. He brings a pasuk, biblical phrase, Som Tatz Melech HaMelech. This is the parasha detailing the appointment of the king. It says, you shall appoint the king. It begins by saying, you, the people. Then it says, Asher Yivchar Hashem Elokecha Bo, that God shall choose. So he doesn't explain how God chooses, but he takes for granted that the king is the choice of God. And he says, therefore, since it is not the people's choice in the first place to appoint him, neither is it their choice to depose him. It is only Hashem Yisbarach. And he goes on and he says that he brings Tukim that he fails to indicate this. And it is not the people's right to depose him, even if he is Begvul HaRisha, even if he is egregious and an errant villain, he says. The most they can do is pray to Hashem and hope that he will save them, but it's not the people's choice to appoint him, it is not the people's choice to depose him. Here, the Abravanel's claim that the king is not chosen by the people is actually, as it turns out, is subject to considerable disputes, as we'll cover in a moment. Yes.
Did he talk about conquest? Because in Spain, prior to the expulsion, there was a lot of back and forth.
A good question. He probably does discuss conquest elsewhere. I'm not familiar with his comments on the subject specifically. The Gemara discusses conquest. The Gemara seems to recognize conquest as having legitimacy and recognition. The Gemara calls it kibush milchama, conquest of by war. The king has the right to essentially annex and to even confiscate property. The property becomes his, spoils of war, as we've discussed in the past. So there is actually a theory, a relatively late theory, but the Dvar Avram actually goes so far as to say that the entire concept of Dina Malchus Adina, the authority of the monarch, is vested, the prime concept, the primal concept is the notion of kibush milchama, that the king conquers, and that gives him his right to promulgate laws, that everything is his by kind of might makes right, so to speak. I don't know the Rabbanel's specific position on this and how he dealt with the changing hands of the Iberian Peninsula between the Muslims and the Catholics and the different, you know, different wars throughout Europe. So it's a good question. I don't know. But, right, he's assuming, we'll discuss a little bit more later, the different theories of different thinkers in Judaism, what they thought was the right of the monarch, a non-Jewish monarch without Nevuah, what they thought, where they thought that came from, whether it was some kind of popular sovereignty or something else. We'll return to that in a moment. Okay, so returning to the third point of the Abravanel, the notion of who does pick the king, who in whom is sovereign power really vested, the Abravanel takes for granted, he says, it is not the people. He says, "Bechiras HaMelech ainah biyad ha'am." He flatly insists it is not the prerogative of the people. Rather, it is biyad Hashem, as it says, "Asher yivchar Hashem elokecha," the king shall be the one God chooses. What does that pasuk actually mean, and how is it interpreted by the commentaries? So, the truth is, most commentaries do interpret it as the Abravanel does, that it means that God has a direct voice in choosing the king. He may not be the only voice, but God at least has a part, some part in the selection process. This begins from a midrash in the Sifri. Asher yivchar Hashem elokecha bo al pi navi. How does Hashem express his preference via prophecy? Ibn Ezra says al pi navi or mishpat urim, either the nevuah or other kinds of divine communication via the urim v'tumim. And that's what the pasuk means, Asher Yivchar Hashem. The pasuk pointedly means the one Hashem will choose, not the one that you will choose. The Rambam, though, makes things a little more complicated. The Rambam does bring the din of Navi, that a Navi is involved in the selection of a Melech, but he also introduces another element, the element of Sanhedrin, of based in Shalshivim Zakenim. 70 plus a Navi, making 71, some say, but the point is based in of 70. So the Rambam, again, if you have a Navi saying, Shmuel comes and says, David is the choice of God, what role does Sanhedrin have? I don't know. The Rambam doesn't explain the interplay of Navi and Sanhedrin. Is it they have to reach a consensus? Are the Sanhedrin going to rubber stamp what the Navi does? Is the Navi going to ratify the choice of the Sanhedrin? The Rambam doesn't explain the interplay of Sanhedrin, as far as I know, the interplay of Sanhedrin and Navi. But the Rambam is introducing another element besides Navi, which is obviously God's voice. There's also Sanhedrin, which to some extent sounds like a popular voice. The Sanhedrin, Sanhedrin is in one sense a court, but it also may be some kind of conclave that represents the will of the people. The Brisker Rav has a famous discussion of two roles of Sanhedrin. One is as a high court. One role is more of a elected, but a body that represents the will of the people. But the Rambam brings examples. He says Yeshua was appointed by Moshe Ubeisdino. Shaul and David were appointed by Shmuel Ubeisdino. However, the Rambam sees that on the Psukim, these respective appointments. So the Rambam already says that there are two elements in the selection of a king, both Navi, which is just divine communication, but also Sanhedrin. The source of the Rambam is apparently a Tosefta that says that since one of the roles of the Sanhedrin, one of their roles is to choose the king. But the Rambam adds, besides Navi, the people do play some role via the Sanhedrin in choosing a king. The Ramban is really the one person who goes to the other extreme. The Ramban seems to feel that, al-Pipshat at least, he concedes, the Chazal may have understood differently, but he says that, al-Pipshat, he would say that the Torah does not mean to say that Hashem has any direct role in choosing a king. He says, al-Pipshat, it is the people's choice. He says it is, you shall choose. The Ramban says, the Torah tells you, don't choose a foreigner, don't choose a Nachri, don't choose a non-Jew. If Hashem is choosing, then Hashem can choose whoever he wants. So it must mean we choose. And Hashem gives us certain rules, certain basic eligibility requirements of who we can choose. So he says, we choose, not Hashem. What does it mean, Asher Yivchar Hashem Elokecha? He has a few different shatim. He says, maybe it means choose one that will be chosen by God, choose one that is someone who God would approve of. Or he says, in a theological sense, we say that everything that happens is, everything that we work out in our world is ultimately the choice of God. Whatever we choose will have been the choice of God, he says. But he actually interprets the pasuk to mean that choosing a king is entirely up to the people, at least what he calls al derech hapshat. But again, even the Rambam, even those who say that it is that Asher Yivchar Hashem Elokecha does mean the Navi, they also have a role for the Sanhedrin. And it's also not so clear what happens when Nevuah is not available. Nevuah terminated in the beginning of the Bayis Sheni. So what happened after that? How were kings chosen? They obviously weren't chosen by Nevi'im. So contemporary Dati Lumi thinkers like to cite a comment of the Radvaz. The Radvaz is writing in the 16th century, a couple of generations after, a generation or two after the Abarbanel. He wasn't writing, you know, kind of in a theological sense. He was just commenting on the Rambam. But when he discusses how a king is appointed, he says either via Navi or Hiskimu Alav Kol Yisrael, or chosen by the people as a whole. And he uses the key word or, the disjunctive or between the two possibilities, implying it's not the Navi and the people, it's the Navi or the people, implying that the people themselves have the ability to choose a king. And the Dati Lumi thinkers like to argue that today, where there's no Nevuah, we can argue that the government, if it's chosen by the people, that has a status of Melech. Voting becomes the act of some Tos Melech HaMelech, voting in the Israeli elections, and a king chosen by the people is a valid fulfillment of the Torah's command of Som Tosim Alecha Melech. What makes this especially ironic is that Abarbanel himself, they point out elsewhere, does seem to feel that the people have a role in choosing the king. Despite his insistence here in his argument in front of the kings of Iberia that the Jewish king is chosen by God, elsewhere he flat out seems to agree with this position that the kings are chosen by the people. In an introduction to his commentary to Shoftim, he says, kings are chosen by Beis Din, which we saw in the Rambam too, but also chosen by the people itself, by the people themselves. He says that, on the one hand, the Rambam says that you need Beis Din HaGadol, Sanhedrin, and a Navi, and a prophet. Milvadze explicitly says, in addition to that, there is an element of popular choice, popular consent. Milvadze, ha'amam lichamosam. The people too has a role in appointing its king. We find that about Shaul and David and Shlomo. we find the people said, Chi HaMelech, or whatever they said, they made some kind of, whether it was a formal referendum or a public claim, whatever it was, but they gave some kind of popular assent to the choice. And he says that, that's what he reads the Pasuk, he says that when the Torah says, Sam Tom Sam Lach HaMelech HaShev HaShem HaLokechabo, so Simas HaMelech, he reads the Pasuk as saying two things. First, Sam Tosim, you the people, you have a vote, you have a choice in appointing the Melech. And also, HaShev HaShem HaLokecha, there also should be a Navi who's giving God's assent, giving God's view of the matter. So the Rabbanel's claim here in his original comment that the people have no role in choosing the king, it is far from clear that that's the case. Rambam says, the Septa says, the Rambam says Sanhedrin, Abarbanel and Radvaz say the people have some role too. It could be Abarbanel thought that because the people don't have the sole choice, if the Navi is involved, they can't oppose him because they would need the Navi to join them in their joint withdrawal of consent. Be that as it may, the point is it's a lot more complicated than simply saying a Navi chooses the king, people have no say. Abarbanel himself agrees with what is an earlier strain of thought. People do have some role in choosing the king.
I don't know if it's choosing. It's more of hakamasa. Because actually, in Shmuel Aleph, like when he talks about why Shmuel is really upset that Bnei Israel want to have a king, mm-hmm. and he actually says there that one, you know, he has a whole long thing there. He says, and what was one of the problems was that they didn't realize that the Melech, because Hashem was their king. Right, and therefore Shmuel chooses, you know, Shaul, and he goes on to why he chooses Shaul versus David and so on, and why did he choose somebody not from Yishevus Yehuda, so on and so forth. But it seems like that the choosing is done specifically by the Navi, because that has to be from Hashem.
And the people
they have to elevate him, they have to
makabel him.
Right.
So I guess Jonathan here, because he could quote the pasuk. But doesn't the pasuk say that when you decide you want a king, and the Chumash pasuk? When you ask for a king, right, so in that sense, the people are choosing to have the king, and once that initial sort of social contract...
So how does it suggesting that they choose the institution, or they choose the concept of monarchy, and then God provides them with the candidate for the position? Interesting, that's an interesting point. Right, so the Pasuk I guess Hadas is referring to, it says... V'amart, it says, when you enter the land of Israel, Hashem Hashem Lekechem Nasein Lechav, Yerushtav, Yerushtav, V'amarta, Sima La'alai Melech, you say, I want a king, G'cholagayim, Asher Sivosai, then, sometimes Lamelech, Hashem Hashem Lekechem. So the suggestion is, I guess, to read the Pasuk, when you decide you're ready for a monarchy, when you decide that you want a king, then apply to God, and God will provide you the person for the role. Interesting idea, yep, yeah, that's, I guess, possible.
Have a chira, right? He's very explicit about that. In what you quoted down here, it's some sort of.
So you're saying the Bechira was God and the people just had the role of installing him in the position somehow. Okay, and that's a possibility too, I guess. Maybe that's what he meant in his comments on Shoftim, that because the people just serve to kind of accept and ratify, they don't get to actually choose, their role is not one who can depose, because that's also a sort of choice that you want someone else. So, yeah, perhaps that's what he held. Okay.
Then it goes back to John Locke, which is the consent of the governor. The consent of the governor. I mean, Jeskimo not calling Israel is consent of the governor.
Right, exactly.
So it was whether, you know, how it's chosen may not be what is key, right, and with the methodology. The other interesting thing is that obviously everybody accepts the fact that it would be a king and not a queen.
So whether everyone accepts that or not, actually, not everyone accepts that. I wasn't getting into that. There is a Sifri who says that Melech v'lo Malka, and the Rambam famously adopted that, and Rav Moshe Feinstein and the contemporary American postgame have by and large followed Rav Moshe, following the Rambam. That's why they, you know, the issues with shul presidents and so on, because which is a topic for a different day. But the point is, not all Rishonim agree with that. There are those who understood Melech v'lo Malka differently, and that's a big topic too. But it's beyond the. I have no problem discussing that another time. But that's I didn't prepare that, and it's beyond the scope of what I did prepare. So I'll leave that for another time.
So the second part of the Radva says if he chooses, I mean, makes himself king by force, not with the Navi and not with the. Right,
that's what I was going to mention before also with regard to what Aaron said about Hanukkah. So again, the point is, the Radvaz also says, that's a very important point, I had forgotten that, the Radvaz also says that The king can be chosen by God, can be chosen by the people, but he cannot simply set himself up by raw power. If he does that, then he has no authority. He has no duly constituted authority. People are not bound to respect him or honor him, and they can simply ignore him, rebel, and do whatever they want. Yes. So the advisor also recognizes that pure despotism, a king who arises through sheer despotism without any kind of popular consent, is also another. Also, he has no authority. Right. Oh, it says he filled up the
Whereas, because by doing that, he was basically saying, "And I will be your king. Whether you like it or not."
That is very interesting. I am not familiar with that, but if we can track that down, that would be an important addition to this discussion. I was going to say the one other source, the Varbanel notes that he's the only one he knows to discuss this question, the right to revolution. And even after the Varbanel, I have been unable to find almost anything on the topic in contemporary Israeli Dati Lumi political thought. There's a lot of discussion about things like resisting unlawful orders in the context of the disengagement and so on. They discussed, there is an explicit halacha that even if a king is a duly constituted sovereign, you don't obey him when he tells you to violate the Torah. So there was a very lively discussion about what is the definition of an unlawful order, of an illegitimate order, who decides what's an illegitimate order, who has power to, so some of the same questions, but that was all a much more specific question about which orders of a, even the Rambam, the Gemara already anticipated the fact that a king might sometimes command you to do something which is against the Torah, and the Torah is a higher authority, and you disobey the king. They're not discussing revolution. They're discussing simply ignoring, disobeying, flouting illegitimate orders. That is a lot of discussion in contemporary Israeli religious political thought. But there's virtually no, that I've been able to track down, almost no general discussion of the right to depose and secede and rebel against the king. The one other source that I'm aware of was shown to me by Rabbi Nathanael Wiederblank, my brother-in-law. He showed me a Karen Ara, who also, his comments are fairly brief, and he doesn't develop this in any depth, but he also takes for granted two points. A, that the king is appointed by the popular will. He doesn't cite all the sources we've quoted, but he takes for granted that the popular will does choose the king, and consequently that they can depose him. He says that Hadavar Tali Ba'am, the entire matter of choosing a king is vested in the people. Anyone they accept becomes a king, and he has the prerogatives of the king. The people have to follow him. And also, he says, they have the right to depose him. And he, as an example of that, this is what I always like to remark, that we talked about this last week, the idea that some of the most weighty and profound questions in Judaism have their roots in extremely technical halachic points, like the Rav Soloveitchik and halachic men. The halacha is, we learn in Vayikra, that if a person sins, he brings a carbon chatas. There are different kinds of chatos. A private citizen brings one kind of chatas. A nasi, which is a melech in our tradition, brings another kind of chatas. Beistin brings a parhalim davar shel tzibur, so on. The Kohen Gadol brings a special kind of carbon. So different categories of people bring different kinds of carbonos. So the Yushalmi, the Palestinian Talmud, has a discussion when David HaMelech was on the run from his son Avshalom. David had suffered through many rebellions in his career. One of the famous ones was his son Avshalom, who had most of the people, I think, were supporting Avshalom at one point. David was on the run with a small group of his loyalists. Yushalmi wants to know, in theory at least, had David committed a sin that would require a carbon chatas at that point in his career, which carbon would he have brought? The carbon of a private citizen or the carbon of a melech? He was a king in exile, a king on the run. What was his halachic status? Yushalmi says, Miskaper b'seira kehedyot. He had the status of a private citizen. He brings the carbon of a yachid. Says the Karen Ara, this Yushalmi is indicating the profoundly important point that popular sovereignty is the order of the day. The people appoint the king, the people depose the king. Since the people had sided with Avshalom, the people had, when they had to choose between David and Avshalom, they had sided with Avshalom. They were essentially deposing David HaMelech. Their deposal of him has halachic validity. David forfeited the status, lost the status of a king. he switched to the status of private citizen, even though he's appointed by a Navi. Even though the Navi, Avraham says he's appointed by a Navi, how can the people override that? Karanara says, no problem. Even though David was appointed by Shmuel, ultimately the people decide. The people say, we don't want David, we want Avshalom now. Then that's it. And then David lost his status as a Melech. That's what he says, Pashta Dekra. That is also going back to the same biblical text, Mikara Bechach Atos Melech HaMelech, Simas HaMelech Tali Ba'am. Karanara strongly feels that popular sovereignty is the key principle here. If they choose to appoint him, he's appointed. If they choose to depose him, they depose him. He doesn't agree with Avarbanel if the social contract is irrevocable. He doesn't agree with Avarbanel that since he was appointed by a Navi, the people have no say. Disagrees on all counts, apparently, and says it's up to the people. They can appoint him together with a Navi. They can depose him. And that's it. That's what he has to say about the question of revolution. And again, Avarbanel and him are really the only two sources I'm aware of who discuss the only sources I'm aware of who discuss the question of a general right to revolution in Judaism or even in governments, monarchies in general. Just a couple of minutes left. It's a few brief remarks on the theory of government and popular sovereignty in general. I mentioned earlier the Talmud has a rule of Dina Malchus Adina that Halacha recognizes sovereign law as being binding even vis-a-vis Jews. Talmud never really gives the theoretical underpinning why is that so, what is the basis for that authority. There are a number of different models, a number of different theories proposed by the classic commentaries. One of the most famous is, one of the ones that has the most traction, the most given the most weight by later authorities, is the Rashbam. The Rashbam, one of the early Baalei Tosfos, the Rashbam says, why is Dina Malchus Adina? Why does Halacha recognize the sovereignty of kings? He says, "Shekol b'nei ha-malchus mekablam aleihem meritzonim." The members of the kingdom, the subjects of the king, accept his authority out of their own volition. Chuki ha-melech, mishpatav. That's why din gamaru. Now, again, this speaks to what Aaron was saying before about tyrants and people who just invade. The Rashbam certainly didn't mean modern democracy. Whether we're talking about the monarchs in time of the Talmud, the Babylonians, the Persians, and so on. Whether we're talking about the kings he knew in his time, in France, and so on, in Europe, in the Dark Ages, these were not democracies. Greece may have had some kind of democracy at some point in its history, but that wasn't what the Talmud was talking about. England had the Magna Carta, but certainly not democracy yet. Whatever it was, the Rashbam did not mean, people point out, our notion of democracy. The Rashbam meant, in some sense, that there is a de facto tacit acceptance. You need some kind of sovereign. This is the sovereign that's available, warts and all. He might not be perfect, but this is what we have. So the Rashbam understood that there is as long as the people are not in, I guess, active revolt against their monarch, they've kind of accepted him. They've de facto accepted his authority. That itself, the Rashbam is really espousing a notion of social contract. It may not be as enlightened a one as the Enlightenment thinkers had, but it was basically an early version of the social contract that, and Rashbam says this is what the Talmud meant already, the Talmud meant that the rights of kings, the rights of sovereigns, is based on, the right of a sovereign is based on some version of the social contract that the people, his subjects, vest authority in him by tacitly accepting him as their sovereign. And this certainly means that the democracies of today, poskim say, alachas kama v'kama, kal v'chomer, democracies of today, which are much more democratic, which much more directly and clearly reflect the will of the people, certainly would be valid as din malchusa under this doctrine of the Rashbam. We complain about our democracy, we complain about electoral college and electoral fraud and hanging chad. Yes, our democracy is not perfect, but it is certainly a lot better. What did the Reverend King say? You know, the arc of freedom is slow, but it bends toward justice. So a similar thing about democracy. We may not be perfect yet, but we've made a lot of progress since the Dark Ages and since the Babylonians and Persians. So this is the Rashbam. According to the Rashbam, the Talmud recognizes popular sovereignty and the will of the people as the fundamental legitimizer of a government. The one other main halachic source for the notion of democracy, this is a tshuva of the Maram of Rattenberg. Maram was one of the first to say it, and one of the most widely quoted, but he's basically reflecting what seems to have been a robust Ashkenazi tradition. He's probably not the first one to say it. There are earlier sources, really, but he says it particularly acutely. The Maram was discussing local government, Jewish self-governance in local communities. The sovereign countries of that time often delegated some degree of, paradoxically, because they were less enlightened and Jews were less, had less equality and less citizenry, the power would often be delegated to the community to run its own affairs, and the community would be collectively responsible to the national power, and the Jews often had some degree of autonomy, internal sovereignty in running their own affairs. So the question was, how should power be allocated? How shall decisions be made? So consensus apparently was the ideal model. The Maram said, ideally, they were trying to reach consensus. But what happens, they asked him, if we can't reach consensus, what happens if the community is split and cannot reach a consensus? How shall we make decisions? How shall we govern ourselves in the absence of consensus? So the Maram's answer essentially is democracy, some form of democracy. The Maram says, if they can't agree, they all get together, they take a vote, and they follow the Rove. Whatever the Rove decides, whether direct democracy, whether they vote on specific issues that are before the community, whether indirect democracy, whether they vote to elect representatives, a kind of council, the Shiva Tuvei Ha'er that we hear about later, whether they elect some kind of local governing body, that is the rule, and you follow the Rove. It's just interesting that the Rove is a principle, majority is a principle that appears all over Halacha. The primary biblical source for Rove is the pasuk in Mishpatim of Achrei Rabim Lahatos, that you follow the majority in the context of a Beis Din. In the context of a Beis Din that cannot reach a unanimous verdict, you follow the majority. That's what we would call a judicial context and how a court issues a ruling, but that is the source for Rove in many areas of Halacha, including questions of Isser V'Heter. You have kosher meat mixed with non-kosher meat. The basic rule that you follow Rove is derived from there. And here, too, here we have what we would call legislative or general governmental arrangements. The Maram says you follow the Rove, and that is also included in the rule of Acher Rabim Lahatos. You follow, the people get together, they vote, they follow the Rove, and that's what you do. So once again, we have the notion of democracy. We have the idea that the people have the right to make decisions for their community. Ideally, that would be done by reaching a consensus, but if you can't do that, then having some kind of democratic process is what you do. You have people either vote directly by referendum on issues, or you have people vote to elect representatives, and that's how decisions are made. So we have democracy in the sense of choosing a melech. We saw that echoed in the Radvaz, the Abarbanel himself, and some other sources, the Karen Ora. We have democracy as the general principle. We have popular sovereignty and the will of the people in some maybe sublimated sense, as the Rashbam's explanation for Din Malchus Adina, and then we have the Maram and the whole subsequent tradition that local affairs, communal affairs, are to be decided by some kind of democratic process, the will of the people, following Rove if necessary, and that's the rule laid down by Maram of Rottenburg.